The subject matter of this podcast will address difficult topics, multiple forms of violence, and identity-based discrimination and harassment. We acknowledge that this content may be difficult and have listed specific content warnings in each episode description to help create a positive, safe experience for all listeners.
In this country, 31 million crimes, 31 million crimes are reported every year. That is one every second. Out of that, every 24 minutes, there is a murder. Every 5 minutes, there is a rape. Every 2 to 5 minutes, there is a sexual assault. Every 9 seconds in this country, a woman is assaulted by someone who told her that he loved her, by someone who told her it was her fault, by someone who tries to tell the rest of us it's none of our business. And I am proud to stand here today with each of you to call that perpetrator a liar.
Welcome to the podcast on crimes against women. I'm Maria McMullen. The concept of intersectionality maintains a theoretical framework for understanding how aspects of a person's social and political identities might combine to create unique modes of discrimination for that person. This is but one high-level explanation of the term intersectionality, a concept introduced by Kimberly Crenshaw some 30 years ago. Since that time, new definitions and uses of the term intersectionality have surfaced and around a wider variety of marginalized groups than Crenshaw had initially intended. Today, as we discuss sexual violence, intersectionality must be broached, or we risk diminishing each woman's unique experience and make the conversation a homogenized version of all varieties of sexual violence happening to all people. Emerging programs in the research and treatment of sexual violence explore the unique needs of Black women who reportedly have a higher incidence of sexual violence coupled with lower rates of reporting those crimes. Their stories, when shared, offer a new understanding of the spectrum of violence and the obstacles facing Black women. Our guest, Greta Gordy Gardner, is the Deputy Director for UJIMA, a project of the D.C. Coalition Against Domestic Violence at the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. An attorney, Ms. Gardner's career as a legal advisor for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking was inspired by her early work as a prosecutor in the Domestic Violence Unit of the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. She has worked for over 2 decades to help shape guidelines, policies, and procedures that jurisdictions can use to end intimate partner violence and develop best practices for prevention and intervention in legal systems, community-based programs, and includes training education on implicit bias. Ms. Gardner sits on the Board of Trustees for Garrison Forest School. She's licensed to practice law in D.C., Maryland, Texas, and the Supreme Court of the United States. She's a certified mediator and belongs to a multitude of local, state, and national committees that address violence against women and their children. Greta, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure to be here.
Tell us about the organization UJIMA that you work with and who's served by the project.
Sure, thank you. So we are UJIMA Incorporated, the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. We were created and founded in 2015 by our executive director, Karma Cotman, and I was a co-founder. Then in 2016, we were awarded a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act, which funds most of the shelter service programs and technical assistance providers throughout the country to address domestic violence. And so our predecessor was the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, which had the grant from 1994 until 2016 when we took it over. And so we serve basically the world as a resource center. Anyone can call us or go onto our website or get our fact sheets or et cetera. Our main constituency are those who are funded by the Family Violence Services and Prevention Act, in which the Administration of Children and Families is the one who oversees that grant. And so we're able to do webinars, we're able to do conferences, we're able to participate in policy discussions, we hold roundtables, regional meetings, and we're hoping to have UJIMA chapters in major cities and in counties throughout the country so that we can have people on the ground who are doing the work so that if things come up or issues are trending, we're able to deal with them not only on a national scale, but also as a local and state level as well.
Oh, wow. Thank you. So to those points, can you offer us some historical context for helping Black survivors of sexual violence and talk about why that's important to specifically help the Black community?
Sure. Well, I mean, I can say from a historical perspective, there's a couple of different layers. In a lot of our trainings, we talk about the historical context of oppression and the impact of slavery and the validity of Black women's pain has been denounced or denied, right? That for a long period of time, that rape against the Black woman was not even considered a crime because she was property, right? And how that has reverberated throughout the course of time and adhering to certain stereotypes about Black women, whether it's the mammy stereotype where, you know, she is there to serve and to be jovial and to caretake for communities and for whomever she's serving. Then who denies her own feelings. Then there's also the stereotype of Sapphire, who is just always angry, you know, kind of like the Black angry woman trope, right? Of like, you know, not credible and always combative and, you know, provocative and always instigating. Then there's Jezebel, right? As far as, you know, being a seductress and, you know, not capable of being raped or being a victim of sexual assault because she's the one who's inciting or in, you know, seducing men. So we have this whole history in the United States of Black women not being deemed as credible, as not being a whole person. I don't know if you're familiar with playing the dozens, where it's a game where like your mama jokes. And actually, the origination of that was that slaves did not hold their value as individuals, that they were sold by the dozen. And so if they had defects or deficits, that did not make them worthy of being sold on their own. Like if they had bad teeth or they were too fat or they had this or they had that, that they were then sold by the dozen. And so we just continue to perpetuate these stereotypes about Black women that have had really serious effects on not only how we respond, how we provide services, who's overrepresented in systems based on stereotypes and biases and prejudices that continue to this day. So I can give you for an example, what we do know from the research and from having some longitudinal data now is that, you know, oftentimes in Black survivors, if they do report and if they do show up for services, oftentimes their safety is not the number one thing that is of concern to them. And so it's really disconcerting to go and ask for help when you're being abused at home and you need help with your utilities or you just need help with your car or transportation to be able to get to work. You can handle the rest, right? Like you're trying to manage the abuse, but you need help with these other things. And to be told, no, you have to call the police, or no, you have to go to the courthouse and get a protection order, or no, your children could be taken away from you if you don't do any one of those things, without giving the adequate time and space and developing a rapport and trust with the survivor of maybe that's not her safest option in that moment. And maybe she really just does need help with her utilities or being able to get to school or, you know, or a safety plan, you know, something as simple as a safety plan, as opposed to pushing towards these protocols that we've put in place that we think are best for everyone, but they aren't necessarily.
Does trauma-informed have a different meaning for Black women or survivors of color?
Sure. So it's multi-layered, right? And multifaceted, because not only are we trying to address the trauma at hand, so whether that's the domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, or what have you, or the incident that has given rise to the response that's required. So whether that's from a community-based program, law enforcement, courts, or what have you, is that we're really encouraging practitioners to look a little bit deeper into how or why that survivor is doing some help seeking, and that the behaviors that you're observing may have some deeper meaning beyond the crisis at hand. So for example, if someone were to appear angry and combative, et cetera, that maybe it's not just because of the trauma at hand, that perhaps she's angry because she's not able to feed her kids. Or perhaps it's angry because, you know, in the area that we live in, which is one of the most affluent Black communities in the country, is her stalker is compromising her security clearance, and her job and her economic viability is really on the line. And so perhaps she's frustrated and angry about that, and not necessarily with the clerk that's trying to help process the paperwork for the protection order. And to really understand, what does that mean in the context of the Black experience in the United States, right? Is that help seeking is not a natural behavior, and that, you know, it's very cultural to not want to air your dirty laundry in public. And so seeking help from outside the family or outside the friendship circle or outside your faith community, not only is not welcomed, really, is not accepted, but it also can be very quite dangerous. So one of the things that we talk about is, like, when we talk about a trauma-informed response is, you know, for example, if police arrive at the scene because of a 911 call, that doesn't always mean that the victim called. Sometimes it's somebody else that called in the community, or a neighbor or a passerby or what have you. So if the police arrive and the victim is angry that the police are there, it's not necessarily because she wants the abuse to continue or she's okay with the abuse, but that could have some very real consequences. And quite often we see an increase in mutual arrests when it's a Black female survivor, right? As opposed to really figuring what's going on. Right. We're seeing more likely an arrest of the abuser, and you know what the industrial prison complex has done to the Black community. And so, you know, this philosophical approach of collectivism of, like, you know, I kind of analogize it to Captain Kirk, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And so this cultural loyalty of, like, if the police arrest him and take him away, what does that do to our family structure? What does it do to the community structure? And perhaps I should just be the community scapegoat to protect another Black man from going to jail. So yes, there are many considerations to take in place as far as the, you know, the decimation of how systemic and structural biases have contributed to breaking down our community. And as devastating and horrible as domestic violence is, we just don't want to see more of our people be overrepresented in systems that harm us.
So that is a perfect segue into what I wanted to ask you about next, which is I want to talk about intersectionality, which is a very, in my mind, it's a pretty complex conversation. But most specifically, what does intersectionality really mean when we're talking about sexual violence for Black women? And then how can that be put into practice?
Sure. So intersectionality is really a philosophical theory that came about with Kimberly Crenshaw out of a paper she wrote from the University of Chicago Legal Forum, demanding the intersection of race and sex, a Black feminist critique of anti-discrimination doctrine, feminist theory, and anti-racist politics.
Yes,
and so
yes,
basically, yeah, right. So I always have to put it out there because when people want to, you know, actually read it, you know, it's helpful to have the title. But so she was, you know, the foremother of this theory, and it really talks about the experience of Black women that you can't break us down into two factions, right? Like the Black part of us and then the woman part of us, that really it's the totality of all of who we are and our experiences that have to be addressed. So, like, a really good example I can give you, and then I will relate it to how to respond to it in sexual assault is, so example, when I was living in Texas and the Democratic primaries between Obama and Hillary Clinton were happening, and people would come up to me and ask me, oh, you must be really conflicted. Like, you don't know who you're going to vote for. Are you going to vote for Hillary Clinton or are you going to vote for Obama? And I was like, oh, people see me singularly, right? Like, so the Black part of me is going to vote for Obama and the woman part of me must, you know, vote for Hillary Clinton, and that people can't reconcile that I'm both, right? And that I actually have to do some critical thinking and looking at the issues. And it's the same. So the way I say is we have to take people as they are. So when we think about intersectionality, I'm actually more than a Black woman, right? So, like, I am a mother, I am a lawyer, I am a daughter, I am able-bodied, I am heterosexual, like, I'm all these things that provide me great privilege and also great disadvantages. And so when I show up, and if I'm looking for help, particularly in a setting where it's supposed to be responding to sexual assault, and people just see my Blackness, then their biases have the potential for creeping in on how they're going to treat me. right? So we know, for example, that Black women are less often seen as trafficking victims and more often seen as purveyors of prostitution. And so that impacts how they are treated, not only by the medical community, but also law enforcement. And so, for example, I had a call in the middle of the night where a sexual assault forensic exam nurse would not give an exam to a prostituted woman because she said prostituted women can't be raped. And so there were lots of layers to that too, that she was a woman of color, you know, she was, you know, had some other things going on as well. So it really is to say that we cannot dissect people by their gender, nor can we do by their race. And so that we have to take them in their totality and respond to the totality of that and understand, what is it like to be a Black woman in America? And so when that person is coming for help, to take into consideration all of the multitude of things and oppression and factors that they've had to endure just merely to survive life, not only the crisis at hand, but that when I show up, I might not be believed. When I show up, I might be followed because it is assumed that I would be a thief more so than a shopper, right? And that all those things take a toll on you after a period of time. And so if I show up and if I say that I've been sexually assaulted, how do you treat me based on your unpacked biases and the work that you have or haven't done to give me the treatment and the respect that I need in order to move from surviving the assault to actually thriving later in life? Because what we do know is the greatest indicia of whether or not a survivor or a victim, however they identify themselves, will participate in the process, whether that's towards healing, and that's in the justice system or through a program assistance or counseling, is how that first responder treats her. And so if the first responder treats her terribly or thinks that, you know, says something like, well, how many baby daddies do you have? Or are you sure that you didn't say yes? Or, you know, any attack on her credibility is going to have a great impact on not only how she goes forward in life in seeking help, but in how she tells her narrative, right? And how she feels about, well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I did bring this on. It's really quite complicated in some ways and really quite simple in others, right?
Are there training programs for law enforcement, first responders, medical professionals specifically on this issue for very particular communities? So, I mean, is there something available for the Black community, for the Latina community, and others?
Yes. Yeah, so we are actually one of four culturally specific institutes that are funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So obviously, we address domestic violence, sexual assault, community violence, structural violence, and systemic violence for the Black community. And that includes the Black community broadly. We define the Black community as within the African diaspora. So that also includes Afro-Latinx, Afro-Caribbean, and African immigrants, refugees, and asylees. Our partners are Casa de Esperanza, and they address all of those issues with regard to the Latinx community. And Asian Pacific Islander Gender-Based Violence Institute, they address all of those issues and crime areas with regard to the Asian Pacific Islander. And so we are all three, the racial and ethnic resource centers. And there's also an LGBTQ plus institute as well that is not defined as racial and ethnic, but is defined as a culturally specific resource center as well. So yes, and to your point, we have a contract with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where I and Tom Tremblay, a consultant of theirs, created a curriculum with the International Association of the Chiefs of Police on how to respond to sexual assault in the Black community. We piloted it in July, and we've done different versions and abbreviations of it. We whittled down a three-day training to a one-day training that we actually did for the Department of the Interior for all of their agencies as well. That was very well attended. It's had a really tremendous response, and so we've been really quite pleased.
Is that a training you're going to bring to the Conference on Crimes Against Women someday?
We would love to do that for anything for the Conference on Crimes Against Women.
We would love to have you. That sounds like an amazing program that would fit right into the conference. So we can talk about that later, of course.
Okay.
So let's talk about today. Let's focus on the present. Are you noticing an impact of COVID-19 on the Black community, specific to the issue of health or sexual violence? What's going on?
Right. So, yes, this is something we've been talking about all day, every day for the past several weeks, obviously.
I'm not surprised.
And so, yes. So what we, you know, at NGMA are particularly challenged by is that we have known for a very long time that, you know, the Black community experiences all these comorbidities and underlying conditions, and that, that there's a dearth of resources and a dearth of medical help around, you know, diabetes, blood, high blood pressure, cholesterol, heart disease, et cetera. And kind of the general response has been, you know, medication and, you know, kind of prophylactically dealing with it as opposed to getting to the root. So we are obviously seeing more issues with COVID-19 with regard to deaths and symptoms, et cetera. The other issues that we're seeing with the quarantine because of that is that people are having to stay in the homes with their abusers, have less of an opportunity to seek out resources, less of an opportunity to find safe haven with family and friends, et cetera. A lot of the co-oping together, and even if it's not your intimate partner, which has been a problem, but also if there's family abuse going on where there's adult parents, you know, elder abuse, or if there's children, you know, multiple children and child abuse, et cetera, and sexual assault has really been a problem. Our challenge has been that traditionally Black survivors don't feel like brick and mortar shelters or community-based programs really are made for them, that they're really only made for white survivors, right, or victims to receive genuine help. They aren't built for them. Like they may not have the ability to bring your own food, or there may be curfews, or you may have to be co-housed with somebody or co-live with someone who doesn't believe in your religious beliefs or isn't respectful of your religious beliefs. For example, you know, if you're Muslim and you need to pray several times a day, and, you know, there's still tremendous bias around that in this country as far as, you know, Muslim Americans. So we are seeing that there aren't increased calls to hotlines or to police. They're pretty much staying the same. But what we are seeing is that there is more need for community-based, culture-specific community-based programs to have the resources to be able to connect. So, for example, lots of people in the Black community don't have a device to use, right? Or they may not have access to the internet. We have found through our other technical assistance providers, even our employees don't have access to internet. We've had to figure out how to do that. In my county where I live is one of the wealthiest counties, not only in the state of Maryland, but in the country, where 1/5 of our community didn't have access to a device or internet. So therefore the schools had to buy 15,000 Chromebooks so that students can continue their education.
That's definitely an issue across school systems nationwide from what I've been reading about. I want to ask you though, specific to the points you were making, do you have any idea yet on what some strategies might be to, you know, post COVID-19 or as we move through this pandemic and things are evolving every day, what strategies may become available for the Black community to help support them, you know, even better?
Right. So in phase four of the stimulus package, what we're asking for is more money for culture-specific programs to be able to do the outreach that they need to in order to, number one, do safety planning, make sure people are okay. We're expecting the floodgates to open once the states kind of release some of the restrictions and higher reporting then. Making sure that we have adequate housing, making sure that we have adequate resources to help people with filing for unemployment, if that's even still available. Making sure that kids have adequate access to educational resources if parents are going to be able to work, because a lot of members of the Black community are essential employees or doing gig economy kind of work. What do they do with their children? Making sure that they have safe places to go, et cetera. Making sure that after this shut down and the quarantine is lifted, for those who want to be able to escape from their abuser, have access to legal resources for protection orders, making sure that they have access to family law attorneys and court processes in order to set up custody and visitation or supervised visitation based on what may or may not have happened during, you know, COVID. Also, I'm on a couple of different committees and strategies around making sure that survivors of domestic violence, that their children are not uber represented in child welfare systems because they couldn't get away from abusers, and that they, you know, we are typically told we expose our children to domestic violence when we don't leave. So the onus becomes on the survivor as opposed to the abuser. So there's a whole host of things that we're just trying to prepare around, you know, reducing food insecurity, safety plans, reaching out. We're having a faith-based roundtable in July to make sure that faith leaders are prepared for when churches open back up and that faith leaders know how to appropriately respond when survivors come and even ask for their help or spiritual guidance.
Yeah, we'll look forward to hearing more about the outcomes of those strategies and things that you're working on. Those are fantastic. You mentioned children a lot, and I think that's a really important part of the story when we talk about domestic violence, because we do talk to and about survivors, but often children are just as impacted, if not more, and kind of lifelong. So let's just talk for a minute about child custody and co-parenting. Is that different in the Black community than you find in other communities?
I wouldn't say different, but I think we are cast in a different light. I think that that's when stereotypes really go just, you know, run away as far as, you know, Black fathers aren't involved, which is untrue. On a couple of committees I've been on, it's like, how do you define involved, right? So, you know, for a Black father who may be underemployed or unemployed, perhaps he is not spending, you know, $2,000 per month on child support, but he's giving what he can. So like whether it's, you know, watching the child 3 days out of the week while the mom is at work, or, you know, being engaged in some other way, or bringing diapers, or, you know, doing what he can, like that's still involved, right? I think that we have a tendency that there is some purpose in perpetuating this myth and this stereotype that Black fathers are not involved. Co-parenting in the Black community is really no different. I think where it becomes really complicated sometimes, and again, where stereotypes come in, is that when you have multiple fathers or multiple mothers of your children, it's like, how do you create a cohesive parenting plan or scheduling, you know, to make sure that the children are provided for? That gets difficult for courts. And I've seen where courts have been really heavy-handed and perhaps judgmental on the faults of parents for not adhering to a majority heteronormative value system. One of the challenges that I constantly place is like, I'm a parent. I have two wonderful children who are 10 and 13. Hardest job I've ever had. I would rather take 5 bar exams in different states at the same time, right? And I would say
agree.
That 10 times.
Agree. Right. Completely yeah. agree.
Right. And so I think that we have this, you know, pie in the sky idea of what parenting should be. And we put really difficult standards that are unattainable on people and punish those who can't meet them. One of the best books I've ever read was even Jim Cleaver would forget the juice box. And it was a chronicling about, you know, moms who overproduce, overcompensate, all these over things. But what was really telling was the actress who played June Cleaver said that she felt so conflicted every day because she was perpetuating a norm of what a mother should be and a wife. But every single day she was leaving her children for 12 to 14 hours a day with a nanny.
Yes.
Right. So I think that, you know, for the Black community, you know, we have a myriad of mothering like anyone else, like other communities as well. We can be tiger moms, you know, we can be, you know, bohemian moms who are just like, well, you know, as long as everyone's mentally happy, you know, it's okay. We don't have to get the good A's. You know, we run the gamut. I mean, and again, that's our intersections. You know, it really depends on where you are, who you are, what family you were born into, what were your resources that were available to you. And I think to a large extent, moms are just trying to do the best that they can.
Last question before we head into our kind of wrap up here. Let's talk about cultural shift for a minute. In your opinion, is there a cultural shift that needs to happen within the Black community in order for women to feel safe in reporting incidents of domestic violence, sexual violence? And what might that shift be?
Sure. So I would change one word in your question.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say there needs to be a cultural shift in reporting. There needs to be a cultural shift in talking about it with each other. One of the things, you know, because reporting, you know, honestly, you know, is still kind of dangerous, right? Because we don't know what the outcome is in all scenarios about reporting. And that can range from it being handled appropriately to nothing happening because she's not believed, to being arrested herself or harmed or sent to jail, to, you know, cases being dismissed because she's being intimidated and doesn't show up to appear, to her being jailed for failing to appear. There are cases where the New Orleans prosecution office is being sued because that they have arrested sexual assault victims for failing to appear, when actually we know that that's a safety plan for many victims. I think that the more we talk about it amongst ourselves and kind of pierce that veil of being verboten to talk about and not casting dispersions on men, you know, Black men are no more likely to commit these acts of violence than other men, but we don't want to talk about it. It's still very hush hush, right? Because they're already cast in a bad light. Why would we put more on them? So, but the more that we talk with each other about it, we can say, oh yeah, that happened to me. Oh yeah, that's happening to me now, as opposed to that wouldn't happen to me, or it doesn't happen to me, and I'm not going to talk about it.
When you say talk about it amongst ourselves or each other, who are you referring to? Is it women or the entire community? Or I just want to understand that part.
I honestly think whomever you feel safe talking with, right? So within the community, if there are friends or allies outside of the Black community that you feel safe talking with or about it, or trying to dismantle the secrecy around it so that you can figure out, like, what's your best strategy? Sometimes I still do a little bit of pro bono work. Sometimes just being able to talk about it with somebody is the only strategy you needed, right? Like, just like, am I crazy? Because what I'm experiencing is this, but he's telling me this, right? So breaking down that secrecy, that mystery, that feeling crazy, the gaslighting, unbundling it and unpacking it so that you know, oh, what I'm experiencing is real. And then, you know, as you're moving through your victimhood and survivorhood and trying to move to a place of thriving, like knowing all of your options and all of your resources so that you can figure out and tailor make what's best for you. Because there is no cookie cutter approach. And I think so often, because of the volume, because of, you know, we have been so ardent in pushing for a response, that we really aren't allowing victims to figure out what really is best for them in the moment. And it's going to change. Right. I mean, I've had people who were, you know, gangbusters about, I want to prosecute, to now I changed my mind, to I think I just need to talk to a counselor, to no, I really want a protection order, to then going back to, yes, I really want to prosecute. Right. I think that we need to stop being ashamed. And I think we need to stop blaming ourselves for, well, I picked him, so therefore I must deserve it. Or, you know, I had a trial once where the victim's mother testified for the offender. And, you know, on cross-examination, I said, you know, ma'am, I have to ask you the question that everyone wants to know. Why would you testify for someone who beat your daughter? And her response was, it's better to have a man that beat you than no man at all. And I think that it's some of those teachings, those old school teachings, and kind of this attachment we have to being partnered and coupled that has this value because there's such a dearth of it that we're told in our Black community, that Black women are not attractive, that we're not worthy, that we don't hold value without a man. And that if we try to get that brass ring of the American dream, which I don't even know what that is anymore, but, you know, the marriage, the picket fence, the house, the 2.5 kids and the dog, that if you don't have that, or that if it's not even attainable, that you're not valued, right? Or that you have no place at the table. And so I think, like many women, like, we make shortcuts, right? And we ignore the red flags because we think that the brass ring either might be worth it, or we can fix it, or we can manage it, or it won't be us because we're not talking about it.
So we're kind of coming full circle here. We started off talking about Kimberly Crenshaw and intersectionality. So I want to ask you a question. Do you think that we as women can come to see each other just as women, even if it's just on this issue, as a, you know, and not separating out the things that you mentioned people would ask you, you know, during when Obama faced Hillary Clinton? You think we can get to that point?
I think it's a both and. Not an either or. I think we have to see each other as women, but then I think we also have to look at and uplift our differences as well, and how that really impacts our life experiences. There are commonalities that you and I will share as women, you know, as we move through this world and try to do good. And that there will be access to opportunities and also barriers that we experience because, you know, you're a white woman and I'm a Black woman. That doesn't mean that we can't collaborate. That doesn't mean that we can't figure it out together and find strategies to help both communities and women in general. But I think that we've been taught for so long that it's a either or. One of the things I found interesting, there's this book, All the Single Ladies book, and it talks about how women are most powerful when they galvanize together, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That for there was a time in our history before the Great Depression where single women who graduated college had nowhere to go if they weren't married. They could go home, but if they didn't want to go home, where would they go? So they created boarding houses. And so when women were living together in these boarding houses, that they realized that there was a lot of power. And that's kind of where the suffragette movement was created and the women's rights. And we became so powerful that rumors began that women who lived in those boarding houses were lesbians. And so they didn't want to be associated with being a lesbian. So the boarding houses started to break up. Right.
And sorry, this just makes me laugh. Okay.
Right. So I think the same is true for women of color and white women, is that we've been told so long that like we need to ignore our differences and just come together as women. And that that has some benefits and has some disadvantages. And that when we can respect both, that that's where we really come to really great problem solving strategies and techniques.
I think that's a really great answer that because what you just said about ignoring differences, we don't even need to ignore them, right? As long as it can be both and, as long as we can have a conversation and lift each other up as women, I think we can set a precedent for the future and for the next generation of women, which is what I really hope comes out of a lot of the work that we're doing at the conference and as well with you that you're doing and others. I have a couple more lightning round questions for you. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. What word do you wish people would stop using?
Strong.
Really?
We're not allowed to say it in our office. We say Black women are resilient.
That's a fantastic word. I love that word. What inspires you?
My children. I know that's a cliche answer. My children.
Yeah, it's a beautiful answer.
Yeah. I didn't think I could be a mother. I had some health issues and I had two amazing kids that have pretty much saved my life and make me just like they hold me accountable.
Yes, so, they do. They do. You gave me the chills. Would you say that your work is intense and how do you combat burnout?
It is. Yes, it is very intense. It's on Mach 10 always. I am not very good about burnout, even though I talk about self-care quite often. I guess my best answer is my girlfriends. Like my girlfriends are everything. Just being able to vent and talk and laugh. And we have dark humor, which, you know, probably if it's ever recorded, like that would be bad. But my friends, my girlfriends. Yeah, they help me like, you know, when I'm sad, when I can't figure stuff out, when I'm frustrated, you know, just being in the trenches with me.
It sounds like you're already living the women lifting up women.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. You're an inspiration. Greta, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I did as well. I'll see you soon, hopefully, for real.
I will see you in Dallas next year at the conference, for sure.
2021. Okay.
There we go. There are poignant lessons to be learned in our work with women who survive sexual violence. Perhaps not the least of which is developing environments where Black women feel safe to report their experiences and where services are available to meet their needs. Consider this thought from Giselle Hunt's Field Lessons from Reporting on Black Women Survivors of Sexual Violence, as the author tells us of her experience just trying to learn about sexual violence in the Black community. She writes, "While sexual violence is universal, there are countless filters through which it is processed. Many cultural considerations can hinder healing for Black women survivors. The burdensome expectation of strong Black womanhood, the power of the Black church, the desire to shield Black men, and the lack of self-care examples are all real dynamics Black women survivors endure. To learn more about this topic and other issues impacting crimes against women, visit conferencecaw.org and find us on social media at National CCAW. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, stay safe.
Interested in learning more about the topics you've heard on this podcast? Listeners of the podcast on Crimes Against Women can receive $25 off of registration to the 34-part web series beginning on June 2nd. Visit www.conferencecaw.org/register and enter podcast 25, that's podcast 25, at checkout.